And I think this optimization can very often lead to us feeling very tightly wound, feel like if we aren't optimizing, then we are failing, which is this interesting thing that I was also reading about the other day that said, you know, it's one of the challenges with goals is that you are perpetually in a failed state until you reach your goal, which is quite something to think about, you know?
And apparently when the full moon would shine into that hole, the whole cave would become pink because of the blood and the light of the moon. Very powerful way to create intentionality and to create your future.
Hi, and welcome to the Expansive Podcast. This is quite typical for the Expansive that we cover a lot of different ideas and content topics. Today, all the way from ritual and sacrifice and doing San Pedro in the Inca Valley and in Peru, Cusco, all the way to habits and artificial intelligence and goal setting. And we cover a lot. It's all in the pursuit of being expansive and trying to stretch our minds and challenge our ways of thinking and challenge our ways of doing, because ultimately we can't stay where we are. There's a new destination to get to, and that requires letting go of how we used to do things and how we used to think about things and how we used to feel about things. And so all in the pursuit of being more expansive.
Tell me, he smoked a whole bubbly on his own.
He would smoke a whole hubbly before going to school, dude. An entire one. Like, and then we'd go to school. After school, we'd play like rugby, and then he would go and smoke again. He was so addicted to it. But I think it's like the habit of having something in your mouth and the smoke that comes out. It's soothing, obviously. And then, yeah, I don't know. Like now what's happening is that you're replacing that with other things because you want the same, but you're not. You want to get the hits from it as well.
I remember my ayahuasca guy, he smokes something called mapacho, and it's holy tobacco, and he blows it on you. It's actually part of the ceremony. And what he was explaining is that tobacco is a very sacred plant, but we in our modern society have like abused it, like in a big way, you know? And I think smoking's just been with us for a very, very long time as human beings. I think it's an ancient ritual. And there's a craving within us for it. I have no idea why. I mean, if we do put this on the pod, this is an X lung. It magnetizes oxygen, which I've not felt jack shit yet. But anyway, I'm still sucking on it because it feels good. yeah, it is what it is. You know, did I ever tell you about the trip I did to Peru, and I did a San Pedro ceremony? And the San Pedro ceremony was really amazing. It was a daytime ceremony. It was in the mountains of Cusco. And I'm going to relate this back to us being in the desert this weekend, because I thought it was a really unique story and a good story. And I think it's something important for us to all take into consideration. So I did the ceremony in the mountains of Cusco with a lady called Leslie Myberg, and she's actually from Boxburg, and she was going through a divorce 30, 40 years ago, and she was going through a tough time, and a friend of hers came to her and said, I'm going on this trip to Peru. Do you want to come with? And she says, I didn't even know where Peru was, but I just needed to get away from my divorce to go and like explore. She says the minute she got out of the plane in Cusco, which is the old capital, the capital of the Inca Empire, it's in the Inca Empire, would take up 8 different countries in South America right now. And geographically, Cusco is exactly in the center of the empire. Now think about this. We're talking thousands of years ago, right? Now, when you go to Cusco, it honestly feels like you're walking through a movie set, because it's really ancient, like ancient, thousands of years ancient. And just a few hours away is Machu Picchu. And what they've actually started to realize now, using LIDAR, they're discovering all these new cities that have been covered by forests and jungle. And so it's really an ancient civilization that Cusco is still around and still quite a bustling town, actually. Anyway, in the mountains of Cusco is Leslie Myberg. And Leslie Myberg has become a San Pedro shaman. think about this, from Boxburg, bro, blonde poppy.
From Boxburg.
From Boxburg, bro. And, but I mean, she's very well established there. She's got hotels, guest houses, a mountain house. She runs San Pedro ceremonies. And the San Pedro that grows there grows in the sacred valley of the Incas. And so you imagine the energy of this plant, which is basking in the sun and the energy field of Peru. And Peru really is a country of magic. There's been such ritualistic magic that's been done there for thousands of years that it's very ritualistic and in that process of ancient types of, you know, behaviors that they have. Anyway, so we go and do the San Pedro ceremony, and it was incredibly powerful. This medicine was, before I even drank the medicine, I was sobbing, like uncontrollably sobbing. And
how long ago was this? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
2017. Okay. 2015, 2017, somewhere around. 2016, somewhere around there. And 10 years ago, 9 years ago now. And we drink the San Pedro, very, very powerful medicine. I slobbered and cried for like 3-4 hours. It was a daytime ceremony. And by 3 o'clock, 2-3 o'clock, they give us some fruit. There's maybe like 15 people there from around the world that come specifically for this mountain house retreat. And she says to us, Leslie says, look, I got a big surprise for you guys. We got some people from the Quechua tribe coming here. And we were like, what's the Quechua tribe? And the Quechua tribe, and I hope I'm not bastardizing the name, maybe I'm getting it wrong, but the Quechua tribe were a tribe that everybody thought had gone extinct. And they arrived back in Cusco 20 years ago. Well, now 30 years ago, because this happened 9 years ago. 30 years ago, and they arrived into Cusco and they couldn't even speak the language because they had their own language, and everybody in Cusco speaks Spanish. Because when the Spanish invaded South America, they stopped them speaking their local language and forced them to speak Spanish. So now everybody speaks Spanish, right? So they come down the mountains and the people say, who are you? And they're like, no, we're from the Quechua people. They're like, no, the Quechua people are extinct. They're like, no. When the Spanish arrived here, we ran away to 6,000 meters in the Andes and have been living up there for 12 generations. For 600 years, we've been up there. And they arrived out of nowhere, bro. So these people are super uninfluenced by the world. If you can imagine, generations of living up in the mountains and survival, right?
Mm.
Anyway, she says, we got the Quechua people, two healers from the Quechua people coming to heal you guys this afternoon. We're like, wow. So these two guys arrive. I have no idea how old they were, maybe in their 30s or 40s, but their faces looked like 12-year-olds. Just think about that innocence that they would have, like pure people, you know? And they come with all their feathers and condor feathers and, like, you know, all the paraphernalia of these ancient tribes. Felt like I was Temple of Doom. I've forgotten his name now. Indiana Jones. It felt like I was in an Indiana Jones movie, you know? Anyway, they do all these healings on us, but look, we're still high because of the San Pedro. We've been crying. I mean, it's a very healing process, but we are still very much in the influence of the plant. And once they do the healings, they said, look, we got another surprise for you. We're going to take you to this temple. It's called the Temple of the Moon. And it's just up from the house. So we get there and it's actually an archaeology site. And they've closed it off to the public because it's such a unique and sacred space. But because they were the Quechua people, they knew the security guy. Anyway, we got it. Now, you know, I want you to imagine this. This is a mountain, like almost a triangular mountain. And in the middle of the mountain, there's a big crack. And the crack is maybe big enough for 1.5 people to walk through. So it's a narrow path. So we go down this path, and as we go like halfway down this path, an opening on our right is there, and it's two caves connected to each other. And the first cave has got carved into the ground a crocodile with its mouth open, and its body tails all the way back to the first cave. And on the walls are three animals carved into the rock. We're talking rock here, bro. We're not like, this is carved into the rock. A jaguar, a snake, and a condor. Now, these are very symbolic to the Peruvian people. And the second cave was a sacrifice table carved into the rock, a very flat table. And the hole into the top of the mountain. And when the full moon would shine down onto the sacrifice table was the holiest time for them to sacrifice llama and animals. Now, what would happen is next to the sacrifice tables were gullyways because they needed the blood to be gullied out of the cave. And so within the cave and the whole construction of it was a way to get rid of all the blood while they were doing this. Now, this temple, this cave was, and this was all being explained to us by the Quechua people, right? They were standing there translating and we were trying to understand them. And they were like, this is for holy priests and royalty only. They would come in here and do sacrifices of animals in full moon. And apparently when the full moon would shine into that hole, the whole cave would become pink because of the blood and the light of the moon. Very powerful way to create intentionality and to create your future. So they give us a 10-minute tour. Now remember, we're still a little bit high on this medicine. They give us the tour of the cave and they say, look, it's nearly 5 o'clock now, so they're closing the archaeology site. You have 10 minutes. You can sit in here and meditate. Just be in here, right? So I sit with my friend Sean, and Sean and I sit on the sacrifice table. Everybody else sits around the cave, and I'm sitting on the sacrifice table, and I get a voice in my head that says, do you want to transform? And I was like, what? I was confused. Who's speaking to me? Anyway, it's like, do you want to transform? And my response was, yes, I do want to transform. And I immediately, without even thinking about it, put my neck back. And in fact, that's exactly how they would sacrifice the animals, put their neck back and cut their necks, right? And as I did that, I started gargling, but quite a loud gargle. And I'm not like that. You know, I'm quite respectful of quiet places. And Sean actually tapped me on me and said, hey, be quiet, bro. I mean, there's people here. I'm like, I don't even know what's happening. I'm like gargling here. And then what had happened in my head was like, here are four things that you can do to transform. And so obviously the voice in my head was asking me to die an old version of myself to develop a new version of myself, right? That was the sort of abstract idea of putting your neck back and gargling because you're cutting your neck, right? So I get four messages downloaded into my head. How to transform. How to transform. The first one, it said, your reality is like a sculptor sculpting a statue. The sculptor that has to sculpt a statue has to continuously carve away at the rock to create the form of his statue. What you have to realize is that your reality requires you to carve it. And in your modern times, the way to carve your reality is to write it down as often as possible. Because in the way you write it down, what you start to do is you carve your reality out. Two, you have to say thank you to Mother Earth. You have to sacrifice something to Mother Earth, give something back to Mother Earth, some food, some coffee, some dried fruit, incense, all those natural things that have come from Mother Earth, we must also sacrifice back to Mother Earth. Now, do you remember when you were in Bali?
Yeah.
Have you been to Bali?
Yeah.
Do you remember how they outside every house you have those sacrifice foods? Beautiful,
love
eh?
Love it.
So beautiful.
Cool. Yeah.
And we've lost love that it. In our Western society.
Yeah. And it's a big thing. Like every single day, someone is out putting out food out.
And incense, all you're doing is saying thank you to Mother Earth.
It was great. Even walking in the, what I loved about it was even in the, in the city where, you know, in front of their shops, people would have these little offerings and things. I thought that was really cool. It's nice. What a way to start your day to have gratitude and a bit of
third
focus
thing.
And,
so first thing is sculpt.
Yeah,
second thing is sacrifice something to Mother Earth to say thank you. Third thing is you must use fire to shift the energy of writing that paper into energy, like into thin air, into the energy form that creates your reality. So you must burn the piece of paper that you use. And the fourth thing you must do is always think you're incredible. And the fourth one I was like, what? I must always think I'm incredible? And later that evening, I was speaking to my friend Sean. I was like, this downloaded in my head. And I'm like, I'm confused about incredible. And he's like, yeah, but if you think about the word incredible, it's actually broken down into internally credible. You must always think you're internally credible so that you think you deserve or are worthy of what it is that you're sculpting into reality. So sculpt, sacrifice, burn, use fire, and think you're incredible. Now, I've been doing that every equinox or new moon, or I do it as a ritual. I write down everything I want. I put all the things inside it that I think Mother Earth would like. I then burn that. I dig a hole and then I burn it into the hole and I say a prayer and say thank you and I leave. I was doing this in Dubai about 2 years ago. My friends and I went into a mountain house and we just went for the weekend. And it was equinox. And I decided to do this while I was there. And my friend Nasima says to me, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm doing this is downloaded for me in this cave." I told the story. They said, "Oh." She says, "Oh, that's called a despacho." I'm like, "A what?" She's like, "A despacho." I'm like, "What's a despacho?" She says, "Google it." I Google it, bro. It's exactly a despacho. I downloaded a despacho. I had no idea. Despacho is a ancient Inca ritual. I had no idea. I was doing it for years and it's actually a thing. Now, we go to the desert on this weekend. And a friend of mine's in the desert and she says, "Mother Earth is telling me that we don't respect her enough and we don't appreciate her enough. And she feels misunderstood and used. And what we need to do is we need to become ritualistic in our appreciation of being here as humans, living out this experience on our mothership. This is our mothership. And we do a lot to challenge her and not take into account just how powerful she is and how much she needs our appreciation." And I thought that it was such a full circle moment for me on Friday when she said that, because I was like, "Oh, I have forgotten to thank Mother Earth and just be more conscientious about living here and just sculpting my way through reality as Mother Earth playing the back, the backdrop into this experience." So I thought, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why I even thought of that story, but I thought it was a good story.
Yeah, that's great. All I can think of is someone listening to the Expansive Business podcast for the very first time and they come into this and they hear about blood sacrifices and rituals.
You know what? Look, for all our listeners out there,
no context for what the pod is about.
I think it's important for us to talk about authenticity, you know, and I think that I am way out there. I know I am. I make a few people uncomfortable. And I think what I do is I bring in the esoteric and it makes people feel very uncomfortable, you know. And I have a good friend, Vili, and he listens to the pod. Vili, how's it, bud? And he often says to me, "John, I like you so much, even though you're so woo-woo." And my response to him was, "I like you so much, even though you're not so woo-woo and you're a caveman. It's okay. Like, it's okay, you know?" So yes, the Expansive Business podcast.
Yeah, listen, this is what the Expansive is about. You know, when we had our book synopsis, because the book is coming out in May and we're busy with blurbs and all the finalizations of what a book requires. And part of what that blurb says, it's combining soul and strategy. And I think it's a good summation of what the pod is about. We cover a vast variety of topics and it's because these things are interesting to us. And so, we go where we need to go on the pod. And I love these. I have a few thoughts on it. The first is that I think we can do with a lot more ritual in our lives. You know, I think there was a time when it was something that was very much a part of our day-to-day. And in certain cultures, it still is. I definitely think on the Western side, we've lost a lot of it. And it's such a powerful tool for helping us to be more intentional in how we live, dealing with endings, experiencing more gratitude. And yet, I think we've kind of replaced rituals with habits in some way, you know, because we still have this need for, we need to do things consecutively. And like, you know, there's a power in that consistency and in that repetition of the thing. But like now we focus on habits instead of rituals, whereas rituals have a much deeper meaning when it comes to what they stand for. And so I'm personally thinking about how do I also build more ritual into my life? I also have a few rituals that I try and get to, but not nearly enough. And I don't think nearly, it's kind of one of the things that I've enjoyed about any sort of psilocybin journey is that there's ritual to it and it feels sacred and special in that kind of a way. So it's worth us thinking about it. And even in the business context, is that as we are dealing with endings, the best way to deal with an ending of leaving behind an old world is to ritualize the leaving behind of it.
It's almost a demarcation. So
it's worth thinking about.
It's a demarcation of shifting. And I think what the equinox and these sort of ancient behaviors had was the ending of spring, the beginning of summer, the beginning of winter, the preparation of it. And I think what's happened is our rituals have become these habits of grabbing a coffee or going to gym, or it's almost like a maintenance of the status quo, not an intentionality of what it is that you want to create. And we've lost the long-term beliefing into reality process. You know what I mean? And I think it's a loss, you know. In fact, what we decided to do in the desert is really go and like just gather some nuts and raisins and whatever it is, just natural things, and go and dig a hole somewhere and just say thank you to Mother Earth. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not harming anybody. And truthfully, I know we're a business podcast and both of us are very ambitious to make money, and a lot of our clients are corporates. What do you want? You want to live a more seamless, abundant life. Doesn't matter what context you're in. And if you are able to tap into ancient wisdoms to be able to bring some level of calmness, some level of respect into our world, I imagine that it would only help. Why would it not help, you know? And so, yeah, I think ritual is most so important, yeah.
For sure. Yeah, I totally agree. It's actually funny because I had a bit of a list, obviously, for things for us to talk about today. And one of the things on my list was the optimized life versus the unoptimized life. And I think it has a good tie into what we're speaking about now. I think we often have this tension, you know, when you look at most of the self-help stuff out there, a lot of it is just about incessantly optimizing every single aspect of your life. Like, how do you get more out of your time? How do you, like, I watched this ridiculous thing about a dude the other day on a pod, and he's like, I have 3 days in the time that you have 1 day. My first day runs from 6 to 12 in the morning. And then my next day runs from 12 to 6. Yeah. And then my next day runs from 6 until 12 at night. So that means I have 3 days in a day. That means by the end of the week, I have had 21 days where you've only had 7. Like, over the month, like, you can't compete with me. And I'm like, dude, like, is that really how you want to live your life? But I mean, this extends into everything. You know, we have a culture that is obsessed with trying to squeeze as much out of every single thing as we can. And I think this optimization can very often lead to us feeling very tightly wound, feel like if we aren't optimizing, then we are failing, which is this interesting thing that I was also reading about the other day that said, you know, it's one of the challenges with goals is that you are perpetually in a failed state until you reach your goal, which is quite something to think about, you know?
Say that again, because I think that is...
Yeah.
That's exceptionally deep. Go.
You are perpetually in a failed state until you reach your goal.
Wow.
Because you haven't arrived.
I feel exhausted, you know, just hearing
so
that.
Every day you wake up not having arrived.
I think you've just described my life. It's like you're constantly like waiting for something, you know, like why? So you're in a constantly failed state until you reach your goals. And the problem is, Eric, you know, I got out of a meditation this morning and I did a long, it's called The Alchemist. I don't know if you've got it, but I can send it to you. It's wonderful. It's an hour long and it's about alchemizing your life. And I came out and I had a booking from America in Las Vegas. And I was so, and in fact, it's changed my whole mood for the day. And I feel so like, oh, thank goodness. You know what I mean? But it also tells you that I was miffed for the last 4 days because something like this hadn't happened, right? Oh God, it's exhausting. Help us. Somebody help us, please.
It is exhausting. And so everywhere you turn, every podcast, every self-help book is about how do you optimize more? And how do you optimize your diet? How do you optimize your relationships? How do you hack this? How do you tweak this? And so there's this movement towards the optimized life. And then the alternative is the unoptimized life, which is that it's it's a lot more open. And I kind of shared a quote yesterday that I think encompasses it, which I won't try and repeat now, but it's the opposite of the mansions and the jets and the fine-tuning and the optimizing. It is the slow life and the calm nervous system and prioritizing
the real luxury,
the relationships,
the real
and
luxury,
your fitness and your health. Yeah, being unhurried, being calm, being slow, being more organic. And I think there's a tension that exists between these two for most people. And I think for a lot of us, we tend to think that it has to be binary. You choose one or the other one. And what I'm finding more and more is that it's really about just the synthesis of the two. It's that you deeply appreciate the moments of calmness and slowness and unhurriedness, and that you don't wish it away, but that you also know that there are certain things that need your attention, that they won't organically just get better and improve. You need to be a bit more mindful and intentional with them, but you don't have to be mindful, intentional to the point of obsessiveness, where the obsessiveness about achieving this goal of optimizing this thing in your life actually becomes a deterrent and becomes something that interferes with the calmness and the slowness on the other side. So I think you get to have both, but only if you are mindful enough to understand the nuances and if you can approach optimizing without the obsessiveness that comes with optimizing.
Do you think it's, absolutely it does. Do you think that ritualizing slowness and optimization is also an important thing to do? It's almost like I kind of get to a part of my day. It's 2 p.m. here in Dubai. By 3 o'clock, I'm not about optimization. I'm really about the slow life. And I think like in the mornings, I am about optimization. I am about 3-4 hours of really focused work, just get all the deep thinking stuff out the way. I'm deep into optimizing. I'm outsourcing. I'm speaking to different suppliers. I'm like the whole bunch of range of things going. Briefings are happening. And then by 3 o'clock, it's like, okay, phew. All right, now let's go into a slow life. Let's go into relaxing. It's almost like I went for a run this morning and then this afternoon, I'm going to go for a walk. Mm. I'm not going to run again. It's like there's a different type of approach.
I like that.
I think to have a ritual that snaps you in and out of each section, which I'm finding more and more meditation to be doing for me, you know, like energizing meditations in the morning and more relaxing meditations in the evening.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And that's what I'm saying. You know, they coexist in your day if you can set your day up like that. And I'm also like, from my point of view, my morning between 5:30 and 8 is just mind and meditation. And I used to try and get exercise into the morning. And I've realized recently, like I'm not getting that right. You know, I'm being very inconsistent with my training. And the reason is that I actually don't want to exercise in the morning. I actually want to just be still and start in a slow kind of way. And I want to do my meditation and I want to journal and I want to maybe listen to a bit of a book and spend some time with the pups. And then I want to make coffee and enjoy my coffee. And then by 8 o'clock, like I'm feel focused. I'm in a good space mentally. I get to go hard until 12. 12, I have my break with the pups for a walk. And that walk is the slowness, the unhurriedness, a bit of a reset. 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock is meetings. And then 3 o'clock, I go and train. And so training has now become how I close off my day.
Nice. Nice.
And
that's
so
cool.
They all coexist.
So you don't have any meetings in the mornings?
I try to put all my meetings in the afternoon as much as I can because I find that in the mornings, that's when I'm at my most creative. So why would I take my creativeness and move it into a meeting? That to me is... So
depends,
as much as I
but
can,
depends on the meeting,
I can't
Eric.
Always get to it.
Depends on the meeting.
Yeah. If a big client wants to meet at 8 o'clock in the morning, I won't say no to them.
No, exactly. Sure. Sorry. But, we're in divine
I need
meditation
to write this
time
email.
There.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. So I try to just optimize my creativity in the morning as much as possible. So when I can have that space for creation and writing.
Do you remember like 10 years ago or even maybe 8 years ago, the hustle culture was such a big thing. Gary Vee was on it. Everybody was hustle, got to move. And I think there's been a backlash to that. And it's the same as the backlash to fast food, to slow food, fast fashion, to slow fashion, to hurry up, to take it easy. And I think there's been a maturity around it in some circles. And I think it's the more immature cultures that are still in the hustle mode. It's almost it's a level of immaturity to be honest. You know, I've said this before, I think on the pod, and maybe I've mentioned to you in private, I was at an airport. I mean, obviously I'm at an airport all the time, but I was once on a trip and this guy was wearing a Louis Vuitton tracksuit, top to bottom, which firstly is the naffest thing ever. If you wear a top to bottom Louis Vuitton, you're a chop. Anyway, but there he is standing and getting totally irritated and impatient. And I thought to myself, dude, you've lost, you're measuring the wrong thing. You've spent, I don't know, an unforeseen amount of money on this tracksuit that you're wearing to fly, pretending like it's just another tracksuit that you wear, whatever. But the real luxury of patience, calmness, and managing your nervous system is really where the luxury lies, but you're losing your shit in your Louis Vuitton. And I just thought, you know what? That is the perfect picture to show you that you're measuring the wrong things. You're not measuring the right things, dude. So yeah, it's cool. Funny. People lose out on that.
The next two topics are a bit more business focused, I guess. The first one is, I want to touch on something that you said in a video recently. So you made a video about, it was kind of your response to all speakers asking you how to be a speaker, which the default response should actually be just don't be a speaker. Like, it seems very glamorous. It's a tough job. That should be your first. That was the only first part that was missing. But then you gave some very good advice. You said, be authentic, be unique. But then the third one, which I found was quite interesting, was you said, don't worry or obsess about speaker bureaus. Do you want to quickly just kind of recap for people what that was about? And I'll tell you where I'm going with it.
I've listened to a lot of speaking bureaus owners speak at conferences. And I'm obviously very good friends with many of them, like Gotham and Gail and Paul. And these are all Marie Gray. Like, I'm friends with them. Like, so I've been working with them for 10 years. So I know their story and I know their spiel. And at the National Speakers Association in America, they said that you got it. And look, there was a lot of new people there and a lot of veterans, but a lot of new people. And they said, look, stop bugging us agents, because just by being on our books, it doesn't mean you're going to get booked. In fact, it means nothing. Like, there's just far too many people that are seeing speaking as a way to, I don't know, some people think it's an easy thing to get up there and talk a story. And it really isn't, because it's a hard thing to be unique. And when I said be authentic and be unique, that already takes 90% of them out of the game, you know? So the idea is that agencies don't want any new speakers. Agencies want to pick up somebody that has already got a track record, that has already got momentum, that has already got a following. That's when it becomes a partnership with the agent. But I also hear from a lot of people that ask me about how do I start speaking, is which agency should I get hold of? And my response is none. Don't get hold of any. Don't do it. You're not going to get any luck. In fact, you're going to irritate them. Build up your own popularity. Share consistently online. They will find you. And the lady, one of the ladies at NSA said, a bureau will find you when you find yourself.
That's good. I also think that the paradox here is that usually in the beginning, when you really need them, they don't need you. And then when you get to a point where you don't need them, they want you. So that's kind of one of the paradoxes. Out of interest, like, how much of your business do you think comes from bureaus, percentage-wise?
It's such a good question. I wish I knew more specifically, but if I had to take a guess, I would say 40% comes from bureaus.
Oh, really? That much?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm surprised.
It's increasing. And you know why? It's because I have more and more relationships with more and more bureaus. So, you know, I must be linked to, I got a bureau in Madrid. I got a bureau in Dallas. I got a bureau in London. I got like three bureaus in South Africa. I got a bureau in San Francisco. I've got a bureau, Gotham. Gotham's another bureau. He's in India, in Dubai. So, I mean, it must be like 8 or 9 bureaus that my relationship grows with them. And so they're putting me more forward more often. So that's growing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's a good number. I think very often for busy speakers, like they might even be at like 20%. And I think that's still a pretty good rate. But the reason why I wanted to touch on this is because I think where that question comes from is that people are looking for the easy way, you know.
Of course.
That when you think of a speaker bureau, you think, oh, I get my name on there and they book me and like, you know, from there on I get made. I guess it's the same as joining a modeling company. It's like you become one of the faces on that wall, you know, and ultimately they always going to have some sort of power law that they work with where they book 20% of their speakers 80% of the time. And it just, like I watched that video and I thought, you know, there's no shortcut. There's no getting around the work that needs to be done. And even if you look at someone like yourself, who's now, you know, 40% of your work might come from bureaus, that is years of cultivating relationships. That's years of finding yourself. That's years of doing the work, years of being on stage, doing good jobs, and getting to the point where they get to see you in action and they approach you instead of you approaching them. When you think of those 8 bureaus, how many of them did you reach out to versus they reached out to you?
50% maybe. Because also what has happened is when you get your brand out there, clients tell the bureaus to book you.
Mm.
And that's what happened with GDA. Yeah. But Singularity, I approached. But Gotham, I approached. But Mina approached me. So like, yeah, I think it's a 50-50 scenario. Both. Yeah. Yeah. It's a 50-50. What is your experience with bureaus?
Sure. My bureau work must be probably 10 to 20%.
Okay.
I'd say.
I'd say well done, Derek. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That you've built it up. But you are so consistent though.
Yeah. I haven't pursued bureaus enough, I think. I do think I can do more in building relationships in those areas. And I am building a bit more relationships, especially in Dubai now as well. But I've been very
thanks
fortunate,
to who?
I think that I've had
Wait, let's just stop here for a second. Thanks to who? Let's give a round of applause.
I'm thinking.
carry on. I'm more than happy to open those doors. Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Pleasure.
And I think I've been fortunate that I've had very big clients. So like even if I look at my roster, I don't have a lot of clients, but I have a lot of big clients that pull me in for many talks and many events.
Yes, says a lot about your quality.
So it's different. Yeah, I'm always happy when I see a repeat client come through. But I just thought it's interesting, you know, it's not that keynote speaking is more different than other professions or more difficult than other professions, perhaps, but it's worth reminding yourself that whatever you are in and whatever you are trying to achieve mastery at, it just takes the reps, it just takes the effort. And on top of that, the person with the best marketing wins, you know, and the more you market yourself, the more they'll see you, the more they'll want to work with you. It doesn't start with you being like a nobody and then hoping that people are going to represent you and offer you shortcuts to get to success.
But I mean, even like I was speaking to, it's a very good point. But even like I was speaking to Richard again about his new book that he's bringing out. I'm like, so what's your marketing plan? I don't have one. I'm like, what? How'd you not have a marketing plan, dude? Like a biggest part of this is like launching and like, you know, like how many, I mean, the effort that you and I are going to put into the expansive book and the launching of it, it's a lot, bro. It's a lot of movement and efforts. And, you know, I often say like in a restaurant, what you need is a old Jewish man in the back making sure everything is parat and right and focused and money saving. And it's very that meticulous accountant. I like see like the 60-year-old, you know, what can we call him? Shlomi. And in the front, what you have is very loud American brash. Wow, hi everybody, have some tequila. And so you actually need both when you're writing a book. Think about it. And when you're researching a talk, you need that very fastidious behind the scenes, but you also need to be loud up front, you know? So it does take a lot, you know? It does take a lot.
Dude, you know, at the end of the day, the biggest companies in the world spend billions on marketing themselves. You know, they don't get to a certain point and go, oh, we don't need to market ourselves. Like we're big enough, you know, everyone knows us. Coca-Cola spends billions on marketing their product, billions on building their brand. If you look at the biggest personal brands in the world, they have the most clickbaity, like, you know, hooky type videos.
Tony Robbins.
Because they know that Tony Robbins, Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, like you name the brand and it's there. And why? Because they know that this is just part of the game that you have to play. And if you don't want to play the game, then guess what? You don't get to play the game. So there's that. All right. I have one more thing that I want to share. And this is a business podcast after all. And what would it be if we didn't talk about artificial intelligence? So the last thing that I wanted to quickly touch on was, I don't know if you've seen this, but Anthropic released their economic index. So for those who don't know, Anthropic is the company behind Claude. They are obviously in opposition to ChatGPT and Llama and all those kind of guys. But they've released this economic index, which is them tracking the impact of artificial intelligence on work. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's going to shift how things happen moving forward. And I thought it was just interesting some of the insights that they had, because what they are now able to do is to see exactly who is using Claude for what sort of use cases, and over millions and millions of iterations. Now they can give us a good idea of what's happening in the world of work with, at least with Claude. So the first thing is they said that what they are seeing is that AI is augmenting jobs and not automating jobs. So this means that people aren't losing their jobs at the rate that we might have expected them to, because they're just purely automated. But more and more people are using AI to find ways to do what they do in a better kind of way and in a more creative way.
That's right.
Half of all of that is coding and writing.
Yes.
So I think we would have also expected that. Coding, you know, I have a friend who's very much into the coding space.
Yaku. Yeah.
And he says, like, what he sees, like, from a coding point of view, like, asking tools to connect APIs and do whatever kind of, like, back-end stuff, you know. He's like, he can't believe how quickly it spits out that kind of code and how accurate it is and how it fixes things in seconds that would have taken a human literally days to do and work through. So, like he says, every day that he works with it, it blows his mind. And he says, like, when if you work with the tool, where every day when you work with it, it blows your mind. So half of all usage is coding and writing, but there's quite a selective adoption. So this was quite interesting. 36% of occupations use AI in 25% of their use cases.
How many percent was the first one?
So 36% of occupations.
36% uses 25%. Okay.
Uses AI in 25% of the work that they do. So it's not as massively adopted as you might think. I think in coding, so what was the two areas where it stands out is coding and sort of content creation / marketing. So 37% of software engineers use it a lot. And then 10% of use cases is purely for ideas and writing and content generation. And I think this is like, it's fascinating to me. Obviously the physical labor stuff, there's almost nothing. So they had forestry and farming and all these sort of types of jobs. Zero impact, zero adoption of it in those areas. But obviously, you know, we've seen the writing side of it, the generation side of it. People are using that aspect of AI a lot. So it's just interesting. You know, we always think that these things are going to change the world in a quicker way than it might actually end up changing the world in. And it's definitely happening. But it just tells me that, like, we don't have to freak out as much as we are freaking out. People have to, they can just calm down. There is time. You can figure this out. There's enough. Like you don't even have to use it in like weird and funny ways. Just start using it for writing and content generation. You're already on par with what most people are doing.
I agree. Two things though. Technology is not a threat until it is. You know, everything has got a deceptive phase. And then all of a sudden when it all clicks, it clicks quickly. You know what I mean? So yes, don't be panicking, but also realize that it's ultimately going to change everything. So it might be slow, but it'll be slow until it's very quick.
Do you remember? Don't panic, but don't do nothing. That's kind of
Exactly. Yeah, but also interesting that only 36% of the people are using it. It means that we are very much surrounded by the people that are using it. So in our world, 100% of people are using it, right? So it's very much our own band of people, because I don't know anybody in my world is not using it. I mean, it would be ridiculous if they weren't using it.
What is that quote? The future is...
The future has arrived. Yeah, it's unevenly distributed.
There we go.
It's unevenly distributed. And that's so true, eh? I mean... You go to some parts of the world and really it's not being used. Yeah. And that's also a good thing to take into account. I actually forgot my last point, but it's interesting to know that. Oh, yeah, here's my last point. Did you see there was a new Chinese AI that just got launched that's better than DeepSeek? The new one. I think it's called Kimi. Yeah, I think it's called Kimi something. It's like faster, cheaper, and more. I mean, like, come on. Like, what?
You just can't keep up.
You cannot keep up at the speed and rate of it. And I've got an investment partner in our crypto world, and we do a weekly investment meeting, and we were deciding that meme coins, we just lose money on meme coins. We don't understand meme coins. We try to understand meme coins, we can't. So we made an executive decision to move all the meme coin investments into AI agent investments. That was 2 days before DeepSeek got launched and took $1 trillion off NASDAQ. And we messaged each other laughing. We're like, what? Like, we thought we were putting our money into something safer, and now all of a sudden we got tanked again. We're like, it was a comedic, actually.
Yeah.
So welcome you to just the end can't of keep certainty. Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, well done. Do you know somebody who gives a talk called The End of Certainty? I've heard this
before. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. I do. Can they book you somewhere?
Very good talk.
Is it a good talk? I've heard it's a good talk.
It's a very good talk.
It's a very good talk. I mean, I've only heard it's a very good talk from you. But anyway, I mean, I'm sure you're not
and
biased.
And the thousands of people online.
Thousands. Thousands.
Yeah.
I think it was a dozen or so, but thousands. Yes, thousands of minds that you impacted.
A dozen might be playing it. But we can find somewhere between a dozen and a thousand.
I'll be happy with that. A thousand.
Somewhere in the middle, I'm happy with that.
We'll stop at 600. 600. 600 people shared how amazing your talk was at Suits and Sneakers. No, in fact, I wasn't the only one who actually said that. Somebody else said it to me that, geez, you got so many comments about that talk. I was like, yeah, that's really amazing, you know? And it was actually a topic of discussion. We were surprised because that's never happened before. So congratulations. I'm joking.